This is the fourth reel of a tape interview with Peter McMillan in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 17th of the 1st, 2003, at the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Obviously, we've been talking about your situation, having found yourselves belly up in a landmine. How did you get out of that?
Well, before we landed, I sent out SOS with the key down so that the mob back at base could vector in where we were.
You mentioned that they dropped a message down to you saying...
That was another aircraft from another squadron. A hurricane came round and it was patrolling the fence between Tripoli between Libya and Egypt. I can't remember the name of the line. It'll come back shortly probably, but they used to patrol that with fighter aircraft, and he spotted us and did a split-arse turn and dropped a note to us which said, "You mugs, you are in a minefield, in a German minefield, stay put. Help will be on its way." And so we did. We stayed put. We were there for I don't know how many hours. It would have been overnight and well into next day. And then in the distance there was a cloud of dust coming our way. And out of the dust appeared a great big tank carrier with a tank, which got off and then approached us. It had a flail in front, and it would have used them, I think, if it went into the minefield, but it didn't have to. It trundled along, and there weren't any mines to go off, so it cleared away, and then a great big truck came in that used to cart off downed aircraft. The men jumped out, and we stood to one side and watched, and they cranked the aircraft up, and as they did so, a bomb dropped out of the bomb bay, the hang-up. There was great scatteration, but I was able to explain to them that the nose cone, little windmill in the nose cone, hadn't come undone and it was quite safe. It was a 500-pound bomb. While they were doing that, another car turned up. It was a sort of four-wheel drive Jeep type thing, and that picked us up and took us back to base. Must have been about 50 or 60 miles away, which is quite a long way over the desert. And we arrived back at base where we were cleaned up, and I was complimented on the fact of how I'd kept the key down, and they were able to pinpoint exactly where we were. When we took off, I think I said there were six other aircraft with us. Two of them managed to fly back to base and land, and the other ones couldn't go on. They had to put down, and they landed with their wheels. We could have done the same thing had we known, but the ground was as hard as cement, and they just landed perfectly with their wheels. They were topped up with petrol, and they could take off again. Our aircraft was lifted up by a large crane and put onto this low loader truck, and it was taken back to the maintenance unit. What happened to it after that, I don't know. We were taken back to base where we were debriefed. Sergeant Scope was subjected to some considerable pressure from the powers that be as to why he didn't land with his wheels down, and All in all, it wasn't a very happy situation. By this time, it was the early June 1942, the 6th of June. I did some flying with a great friend of mine from Perth called David Leake, and David and I flew around the countryside. He was familiarizing himself with the aircraft, and he took me with him as his wireless operator so that I can keep my hand in on the wireless.
How did you actually sort of cope with your initial experience of being on an operation, being in a military combat situation?
Quite frankly, it didn't really sink in very well with us because we were complete sprogs. In other words, we'd never had anything happen to us, and it was just a big adventure.
Had all the training sort of made everything second nature?
Oh, yes. Yes, it helped a tremendous lot because we knew where everything was. Well, I did. At the back of the aircraft, I knew where everything was, where the lines went to with the... electricity, the whole works. I could check out the sheet for a Baltimore and know exactly where all the fuses were, and I knew exactly where everything was. It was pretty good. I also knew the front of the aircraft as well, where the observer sat, and I could understand what was happening there, and I could understand what was happening with the pilot.
I've had the actual experience, and obviously, again, you landed in an awkward situation. But had the experience at this time put you off the idea of continuing?
Oh, no, it hadn't put me off. It had brightened me up, actually. I think it had really, this last one where we went on our guts in the desert, I was pretty finely tuned, and I had the gunner who was very, very sproggish, Jock the gunner. I had him out the hatch and on the ground before he even knew it, and I was out on top of him. Having had a prank before that burnt, I knew exactly what was going to happen if it was going up. You could get to the situation where you knew exactly what to do, and this was the thing. One thing I do know is that if it ever came to bailing out of the Baltimore, we in the back never ever would have made it. And I think I've said this before, because our chutes were put on the side of the aircraft and held in place with hockey straps, and we never would have got away.
You mentioned that you've been debriefed. How successful had your trip to Benghazi been? How did you find out?
We never found out. This is another thing that bloody jacked us off. The powers that be sort of didn't exactly come to our side of things and tell us what we'd done. All they wanted to know was what we did. We didn't know whether we had done any good or not, which was sad. Later on, this altered considerably, and it was all due to the efforts of the higher-ups in the squadron who were very sympathetic to what was happening with the mob that were going on operations. And when we used to get debriefed, later on, we were usually told that, oh, it was a bloody good job, you did this or you did that, and it was much better. After returning to base and having my little few hours with David Leake, I got back with Merv Scope again, with all our crew, and we did a lot of work, local formation flying. It was routine sort of stuff, flying from one base to another and practicing landing and takeoffs and things like that. And then it got to the stage where we ferried aircraft, and we used to take the old or the aircraft that were run down from the squadron back to the maintenance unit, and then pick up a good aircraft and bring it back to the squadron again. So I did that with scope for 3 trips. And then on the 22nd of June 1942, I did my last trip with MIRV scope. I've got here my last flight with MIRV scope. He was taken off ops flying and transferred to a maintenance unit as a test pilot. With him, I'd had 3 pranks. Now, that was a sad situation for me, because from the 22nd of June to the 31st of August, for 70 days, I was left in limbo, and I had very, very low morale. I had no pilot, no crew, no nothing, and I was just left.
In relation to the general situation, things are beginning to heat up, ending up obviously in October when LMMAN starts.
Yeah.
Have you heard, for instance, about the situation in Tobruk?
Yeah.
Tobruk and Fall. What was the general attitude towards that?
We just wondered how we could help or what we could do. That was it. My very, very great friend, the bloke that I trained with in Australia and came away with, young Stewie, he got killed at Tobruk in a Baltimore. They used to send Baltimores over from the squadron to bomb areas at Tobruk. It was just suicide. It really was, because the Baltimores had no real means of combating a German fighter. And Stewie got killed with his pilot, who was another great mate of mine. In all, I think we lost 5 aircraft going to bomb bloody places around Tobruk before things happened there.
Obviously, the situation is looking grimmer than it has for a while, I suppose. What was the feeling to know that Tobruk was no longer in the hands of the Allies?
Well, for us, it really didn't affect us very much. We did know that it meant that we were going to be in trouble if Rommel came on through and got through into Cairo. And that's where the Alamein push started.
In relation, you mentioned, obviously, your mate leaving. What was it like once you'd sort of made these bombs to have chaps that didn't return from missions?
It was horrible.
How did you sort of cope with that situation?
Oh, well, you just had to cope. It was just one of those things. When Stewie went, that shook me to the ribs. A lot of the kids that went on ops and were shot down, they were friends of ours, but we just had to accept the fact that bad luck, he's gone. And that was it.
So the job in the fact that you were lucky it wasn't
you. Yeah, that's right. Well, thank Christ it wasn't me. Yeah. That's about the way it used to feel. I was really and truly very, very low in morale. And I used to mope around, and I had nothing to do. And one day, the CO of A Flight, a very nice bloke, he was a POM, which was amazing, came to me and said, "McMillan, you've rotted for too long." He said, "I'm going to put you in as a wireless operator with Flight Sergeant Harland." That's Les Harland. He was an absolute crackerjack bloke. He ended up as Air Vice Marshal. But he was a flight sergeant, and I flew with him for 9 or 10 operations for the Al Alamein do. It was a very, very morale-boosting effort. and we carried out our bombing raids in boxes of 18 football teams. We used to go out at all odd times to bomb along the bomb line at Alamein. You could see the tanks down below you from 10,000 feet, little tiny pinpricks, and our bombs used to drop in amongst them and create havoc. It was due to our efforts and the other efforts of the squadrons too, I think, that broke things up.
I understood that you talk, you see the tanks that you're dropping the bombs amongst and the havoc that you're causing, but I also understand that there is this sort of sense of isolation. You don't actually know what you're doing mess-wise.
No. I mean, there's a picture of one of Percy Carruthers' aircraft that got shot down. Probably in the picture around there would be tanks. Somewhere later on, there's a picture where we drop bombs, and you can actually see the bombs there dropping in amongst them. You see little tiny dots here and there with the tanks. Now, each one of those bombs was a 250-pounder, and when it went off above the ground, it probably covered an area of about 250 square metres of shrapnel. Absolute hell. We can imagine each aircraft dropping six, and there are 18 six. There are a lot of things going down there. It must have been an awful bloody situation. The Germans didn't like it at all. And it was flying with leads that I eventually came to the conclusion that I'm flying in a war and I'm being shot at and I could be knocked down very easily.
What sort of philosophy did you adopt to cope with that and also to cope with what your job was?
Well, there wasn't much of a... Well, it wasn't much to think about, really. I mean, before you took off for an operation, admittedly, you had butterflies in the guts. A lot of us didn't want to eat. A lot of us didn't want to drink. We didn't hardly wanted to talk. We just wanted to get on with the job. Once you got into the aircraft and sat down in your position and got to work and did things, it was entirely different. We were on the job and that was it. When you were flying out, going towards the bomb line, you were in formation and you could see the other mob in formation with you, and you knew that they were all there, we were all here, and there was a whole mob going out, and I'm going to come back. We all had that feeling. None of us were feeling that we were going to get knocked down. It was a different situation when we got to the bomb run, because if you flew in very high, in other words, if you flew in to bomb over 12,000 feet, the Germans would bring their very heavy artillery into action, 105 millimetres, so 12 to 18,000 feet. When you drop down, as we did, we used to bomb from 10,000 to 8,000 feet. We had 88 millimetre, which was bloody awful.
I've heard infantry chaps talking about the 88 millimetre, but what's it like to be fired by an 88 millimetre aiming at you in the
It's bloody awful, I can tell you, because the 88 millimetres, it was all predicted, and they would pick you up coming in from a certain direction. They could pick out your height and your speed and your direction, and then they would aim their guns on that predicted thing and fire. However, we had a little way of getting over that, because about 5 minutes from dropping the bombs at the spot, we used to start to lose height, and you'd weave from side to side. So the whole box would do that. If you kept level, straight and level at the same height, you were a sitting duck. So we used to do that, and then we would see the flat over here behind us, or sometimes it would be over there in front of us, but if you weaved, it got us away. The Jerrys got to know this, and they used to sort of try and pick out where you're going to weave, and they got Percy Carruthers, who was doing that very thing. Percy, when he was shot down, I've got here, had Joe Pearson, our observer from Merv Scope's crew. He was on board and he was killed. Percy, being a pilot, he could bail out. Joe was an observer. He should have been able to bail out too, but apparently he must have been killed. When the aircraft were dropping their bombs, you naturally had to keep your aircraft straight and steady, and that was about the worst time. I used to shit myself about that stage with anxiety, because the flak was very quick, or the guns down below were very quick to lock on to what you were doing. And we used to, I think, have 30 seconds to 45 seconds on straight and level so the bomb aimer could drop his bombs. As soon as the bombs were dropped, you would hear bomb doors closed, weave, and that's what would happen. And the whole of the box would then weave away. Oh, Jesus. It was terrific, really, to feel that we'd done that. Here we've got, in one of our bombing raids, 6 by 250-pound bombs on enemy MT, 9 holes by accurate and heavy ACAC, starboard flap connecting rods shot away, which meant that when Les Harland came into land, he put down the flaps and... One flap didn't work. It's a wonder we didn't go over. But our gunner said, I think there's something missing in your connecting rod on the flap. So on that particular one, that's the first one that we had anything happen to us, he did a very, very long, low approach, landed without flaps. Which is, in the Baltimore, you're doing a fair speed when you hit the deck.
So the flak, I mean, you're flying through flak. It would often, you have shrapnel flying through the plane.
I can't remember ever having in our aircraft anything very serious happened, but I can remember coming back and there would be holes in the fuselage and holes in the wing. But they weren't big holes, they were about so big, a couple of inches across. Later on, when things got a bit more fierce, big problems used to happen sometimes. My last flight with Les Harland was on the 5th of December, of September, in 1942. And then interesting things began to happen because...
We talked about the beginning of LRNA in October. The build-up that was to occur in relation to supplying the army with tanks and the build-up of air power as well. How did that make itself known?
Well, we never ever saw very much of that going on because we were well away from those sorts of places where MT would be going past. But we used to see when we took off and going over the roads, we used to see miles of trucks and things going up. was a bit different to when we first went up to Benghazi with miles of trucks, and then we got turfed and sent back because we had miles of trucks coming back. This time there were miles of trucks going up towards Alamein, and they really were very impressive.
How did that make you feel in relation to what was like a turnaround?
Oh, I thought it was terrific. At least we've got something. We've got something going to happen now, and we're going to get the Hun on the run. On the night that Alamein started, and I don't know if I've got it here. I can't remember when Alamein began.
It was 23rd of October, I understand. There's a big barrage to start it all. Before we get to that point, obviously there have been some changes in command, and Montgomery had become chief commander of the 8th Army. What did you know of that situation?
Not very much. Not very much at all. Alexander was in charge before, but he got taken away and sent somewhere else. I think he took over on a higher job somewhere. Montgomery just took charge of the whole of the works.
What did you know of Montgomery up until that point?
Not very much. We did meet him, and I think I told you about that time we came across him. And
tell us about that. I don't think we have it on tape.
I couldn't give you the date at all, but there was a big build-up of army all around where we were. We used to go on leave into Alexander, short leaves, and Kevin Natras, who was our wireless operator, and I missed our bus back to the base. So we took off and began to walk back from Alexandria back to LG 86, which was quite a long way. And of course, we were thudding lifts along the way. As we went along, a staff car pulled up alongside us, and this abrupt voice from a man sitting in the back said, "Where are you men going?" We told him. And he said, "Why are you walking?" And we told him we'd missed bus. And he said, "They're very careless of you," in an abrupt voice. He said, "Get in, I'll give you a lift." So we hopped in, and it was Montgomery. He was very nice. He was abrupt, but he did speak to us and said, "What have you been doing?" And we told him, we said we'd been dropping bombs on Huns, and that we were members of the football team. "What football team?" And we said the blocks of 18 aircraft. We had to explain that to him. And he dropped us off at our air base and then went on, and that's the last we saw of him.
It was sort of late in the evening and you're a little bit worse for weather.
Yeah.
Worse for weather. What was his attitude towards finding young airmen?
Well, I think
he
was sympathetic to the fact that we had missed our bus and we were trying very quickly to get back to base. We weren't over time, that's for sure. We explained that to him, and that we were trying very hard to get back in time to base.
What sort of character was he? I mean, you mentioned he was a nice chap.
Well, he was very abrupt. He seemed quite a kindly sort of type. But I can't say anything more than that because we were rather overawed. We were flight sergeants after all. Yeah, he was very nice. Yeah.
How did he talk to you in relation to how he thought things might be going?
Oh, no.
Or
no.
How he sort of perceived the situation?
No, none of that was discussed at all.
Boosting of morale?
Yeah. No, I think that... When he dropped us, he said, "Best of luck to you boys, and we'll see you much later on," sort of thing. But that was it. No,